support comes from the law firm of Thompson Hine, delivering employee benefit solutions uniquely suited for your business. More information about Thompson Hine's employee benefits practice can be found online at thompsonhine.com.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Pope Francis has brought a few firsts with him to the Catholic Church as the Pope. He's the first Pope from the Jesuit order. He's the first Pope from the Americas and the first born in the Southern Hemisphere. In his first year as Pope, he also made headlines for his statements about abortion, gay people, divorced Catholics, and most recently, the economy. And his simple ways have both endeared him to the public and troubled those, or some, who prefer a more distant and glorified leader of the Catholic Church. His popularity is obvious. He was named Time's Person of the Year, but he's also caused some controversy among conservatives. We'll hear from a conservative Catholic columnist later in the show. Joining us now by phone from Washington, D.C. is Michael Sean Winters, blogger and columnist for the National Catholic Reporter. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you, Ann.
Michael, a few weeks ago, the first major work by Pope Francis was released. It was an apostolic exhortation called The Joy of the Gospel. It contained language that seemed critical of capitalism to some. Can you first tell us what this kind of document is and why it caused a stir?
Well, there are different types of papal documents. And last year, there was a synod on evangelization, and where bishops from around the world came together to discuss the topic. And at the end of each synod, the Pope takes all the different comments and puts them together into a document. This document is slightly different from a traditional post-synodal exhortation in that it really reads like an inaugural address. He is setting out his program, certainly encapsulating in one text some of the themes we've heard him talk about in interviews or in these little morning sermons that he gives. What is different here is this is papal teaching. You know, the Italians have a saying, the Pope is either teaching or he's talking to the pig farmers in Sicily. An interview or a little sermon is not doesn't have that gloss of officialdom. And so what now we see is these comments about the economy, about poverty, about income inequality that have been running through his pontificate that you saw the first moment when he chose the name Francis. Mm-hmm. This now has an official seal and stamp and is laid out in a very programmatic way.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Michael Sean Winters, a blogger and columnist for the National Catholic Reporter. We're talking about Pope Francis. Lately, he's been causing a stir, particularly among American conservative Catholics. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. When Pope Francis succeeded Benedict, he was said to charm the world. Has that changed in essence? In other words, has the charm worn off? Is it, you know, is the honeymoon over?
I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, 92-94% approval ratings from Catholics. Now, no pope really governs with a view toward approval ratings. He's not going to face re-election 4 years down the road. So it's a different animal. But there is certainly a sense in the pews among most of the bishops that the church just has gotten some fresh wind in its sails from this pope, that after years of a kind of gloom and doom narrative that we may need a smaller, purer church, all of a sudden this guy's reaching out and saying, no, that's not the narrative. Our Lord Jesus Christ is the Lord of history, and he is still active in the world, and he needs to be active in us, and that the way that you make sure you are actually carrying out the Lord's work and not letting your ego trump the message is to be out amongst the poor. And I think that is resonating, unsurprisingly, because it is pretty much what Jesus did when he walked on the earth.
I know you work for the National Catholic Reporter, but sometimes we get calls from people after programs like this saying, why are you talking about the Pope all the time? Which, of course, we aren't. But the Pope, his messages and what he says resonates beyond just Catholicism. Am I wrong? And why is that?
Well, I think part of it is the nature of the Catholic Church, whereas the Episcopal churches, the Methodist churches, the Presbyterian churches, don't have one worldwide leader. The Catholic Church still has that. The Orthodox churches don't have that. Buddhism doesn't have that. The Islam does not have this. Judaism doesn't have it. So that's part of it. And obviously the papacy has just been a central role in Western history. That said, I think what this pope has that his predecessor lacked, now, and let me be clear, I loved Pope Benedict, and I loved the density of Pope Benedict's writings and of a Pope Benedict sermon. They were wonderful to me, but I spend my life with books on the Catholic Church. This guy is so accessible. There's no mistaking his meaning. He used the word sourpusses in this exhortation.
Okay, so you mean I could understand what he said. Okay.
You know, okay. Exactly. And so I think he's resonating in a way his predecessor might not have, just because of that accessibility of language. He was a pastor. You know, Pope Benedict was a theologian. John Paul II was a scholar. This guy has spent his life in the trenches as a pastor, and it really shows. I mean, there is a sense... In the first week of his papacy, he went to the little parish church in the Vatican and said Mass, and he stood outside and greeted people as they left after. And I remarked at the time, I said, you know, he's turning into the parish priest of the world. And it turns out the world really needed that, whether it wanted to recognize it or not. And I think they're responding. They want to be given hope. They want to be told there's more to life than material acquisitions. That it's not all gloom and doom. And I think he's just resonating in ways I'm always hearing from priests about people who have come back to the church who they haven't seen in years. And it's just a very, very exciting time.
When did the question, and we're going to be coming up talking to a conservative Catholic, Matt Abbott, a columnist for Renew America, a politically conservative website, coming up later. But could you set the scene for when the question of whether he's a socialist arose in the public discourse?
Well, when he issued this encyclical, I mean, some people have been worried about some of the things he's said or some of the things he's done. You know, he doesn't dress up as much as Benedict used to, so the traditional Latin Mass crowd was very nervous. He said, you know, the church can't be only obsessed about abortion, same-sex marriage, and contraception. This upset, you know, certain types of conservatives. The economic critique was so clear and so pronounced in this exhortation, that is what provoked Rush Limbaugh to say he was spouting Marxism, and now Sean Hannity has weighed in, and some others. And I think there is, but in fact, this is one area where there is incredible continuity with Pope Benedict and Pope John Paul II, and Bishop, and popes going all the way back to Leo XIII in 1891 issued an encyclical Rerum Novarum that really kicks off papal social teaching. And even back then, he favored the rights of workers to unionize, warned about unfettered capitalism. In 1931, Pius XI referred to the poison spring from which these individualistic economic ideas spring, come forth. So this year, he's in deep continuity. I will remind my conservative friends that 1 year ago, when Pope Benedict issued his last World Day of Peace message, he listed unfettered capitalism alongside terrorism and international crime as major threats to world peace. And so here's an area where Pope Francis is in deep continuity. What you can't have with this pope, getting back to the last point, is when Pope Benedict issued his social encyclical on economic issues and social issues, Deus Caritas Est. George Weigel said, oh, well, you have to read this with a red and gold pen, and the gold sections are from Benedict. The red sections, that's just from the bureaucracy. There is no mistaking this pope's words. They don't really require a great deal of interpretation. It's very clear what he's saying. And as often as not, because he's not speaking from a text, you can't blame it on the bureaucracy.
Joining us now is Leo Madden. He teaches theology and is the head of the Department of Theology at Ohio Dominican University. Welcome back to the show, Leo.
Good morning. Welcome back. I'm happy to be here.
So what about this encyclical and how it's interpreted? Do you agree with Michael Shawn Winter's interpretation?
Yes, I largely agree with what Mr. Winters had to say. I would just add one more thing. He emphasized that with this document, we read here the unmistakable program of action that this pope wishes to carry forward during his pontificate. And I would add also this, that this document reads as if this is what the cardinals of the conclave wanted to have happen. This is what the large majority of bishops around the world wanted to have happen. And certainly this is what the bishops who attended the Synod on Evangelization
wanted. It reads that way.
It reads that way. It's as if there are frequent references to what was stated at the Synod publicly by a bishop or a cardinal. There are many one gets the sense, I got the sense from reading this document that, piggybacking on something that Mr. Winter said a moment ago, that the last 10 or 15 years of John Paul II's pontificate was something of a period of stasis. You know, John Paul II was ill for much of that time, even though he did travel a lot. But the structures and the way the church conducted itself in its everyday life around the world remained the same. Then with Pope Benedict, this continued, remained the same. And now with this apostolic exhortation and the emphasis on new evangelization, we see an openness, a willingness to think outside the box, to use a cliche. What might be new ways in which we can advance the gospel, tell the wonderful, joyful story that might give hope to people around the world, especially the hope to the poor?
I was going to ask both of you if the cardinals knew he would be this type of pope, and you're saying,
absolutely.
They knew what his temperament was, what his inclinations were.
Absolutely. I think they knew, because he was, from all internal, we don't have the voting
exactly
from 2004 conclave, but it seems to me that he was the very strong contender, right, at that conclave. And many cardinals at the conclave knew who he was then, and they knew whom they were voting for at the most recent conclave. And so they knew they were getting somebody, and this is what was a key objective they had at the conclave. You recall, prior to the conclave, the cardinals met in their morning conversations, and even in public interviews, the refrain came out repeatedly: we want someone who is transparent. We want someone who can communicate to the world the love and the mercy that is offered by God in Christ. This is what we want. And so, and this is whom they voted for as the one who would best exemplify that purpose.
And just before we take a break, Leo, they want someone who can communicate to the world. They see that role then of the Pope.
Yes. Yeah. It's as Mr. Winter said, it's clear that the Pope, from in large parts of the world, the Pope is the visible sign of Christianity. And what the Bishop of Rome does on a small scale or on a large scale, the media picks up on. Any hint the media picks up on. His gestures, as we've seen in the last 8 months, his gestures go clearly out to the world and have an impact on people's hearts.
Okay, we will return to our conversation about Pope Francis and the impact he's had in the first several months of his tenure when we return. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about Pope Francis, what's made him so popular, and why some question many of his statements. Still with us, Michael Sean Winters of the National Catholic Reporter, Leo Madden, head of the Department of Theology at Ohio Dominican University, and joining us by phone now from Chicago is Matt Abbott. He is a Catholic columnist for Renew America. It's a politically conservative website. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thank you very much for having me on, Ann.
You were quoted in the New York Times saying that for Orthodox and conservative Catholics, the last few months have been a roller coaster ride. Can you elaborate on what you meant by that?
Well, I think many conservative Catholics, including myself, are still getting used to the Pope's style, which is certainly different from that of his predecessor. And I think, being that he does have an off-the-cuff type of style and delivery, it can make it, I guess, a bit of a challenge when certain statements, you know, are made and they're reported in the press. And there isn't always the nuance that you will find in certain writings. But nonetheless, it while on one hand it's refreshing, it does make for some interesting debate and in some cases, I guess, concern among conservative Catholics about the direction that Pope Francis is going in and, you know, where he wants to lead the Church and who he's trying to reach out to. And so I think in that respect, you know, there is a sort of roller coaster ride. And I think it is leveled off some. I think that, you know, there is definitely certain things about this Pope that are very refreshing. But, you know, there's always the possibility that, you know, tomorrow or the next day, the Pope is going to make a statement in an interview, and it, again, you know, may make headlines for better or for worse, and a number of people then will be discussing, you know, what he is trying to say and how it relates to church teaching and so on and so forth.
You know, when you put it that way, and when I'm listening to you answer that question, I realize what the references are to Joe Biden, Vice President Joe Biden, the off the cuff, the you never know what he's going to say, and then you have to figure out what he meant by it, and that kind of a thing. The editor of The Economist's religious blog has said that his views, the Pope's views on the economy, sound ill thought out, and others have questioned his intellect, that he's not the sharpest, best educated Pope, than that it shows. And of course, Michael Sean Winters of the National Catholic Reporter talked about how he was, you know, that's where he comes from. He comes from a place where he was speaking directly to people, and that's the way his writings sound. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that, you know, when it comes to economics, and of course I'm not an expert in the area of economics, but I find that there is a healthy debate going on there, and I think that you do have a number of conservative Catholics who were, I guess, concerned about or in some cases even upset with what Pope Francis wrote regarding economics. I'm not one of them. I really don't find them particularly controversial. I think, you know, the Church has always viewed, of course, socialism, communism is something that's wrong, but also unbridled capitalism. Therefore, you know, the Church has sort of looked for a middle ground. And I really think that's what Pope Francis is trying to lay out, again, in terms of specific economic policies. That's something that, you know, is open for discussion and debate, but I can understand why some conservatives were, I guess, a little taken aback with what he said in regard to economics. But again, I don't find them particularly upsetting. And, you know, it's not an area that really concerns me greatly. I think he does have a good knowledge of church teaching in regard to social doctrine in regard to you know, the economic realm, and again, I recognize that there are those experts in the area of economics who would have legitimate critiques of what, you know, he has written, and it is an interesting area, certainly. Mm-hmm. But it's not something that I particularly have chosen to focus on in my columns.
Leo Madden?
Yes, if I could just add one thing to what Mr. Abbott just said. There's one paragraph in the Apostolic Exhortation that caught the attention of many people who wanted to criticize the Pope in his economic statements, and that was when he criticized trickle-down economics. And the unfortunate thing there is that the term in Spanish is not the same meaning as the term of trickle-down economics that we understand in American economic history of the last 60 or 70 years. Rather, what the Pope is talking about is a system of social and economic policy governed by elites, where the elites who control the money supply and the major industries control the system and arrange the system so that they get wealthy. And it is their understanding or their conceit that, well, if we get wealthy, we will have some of our excess spill over, that's the term in Spanish, to spill over onto the poor, and somehow or other, the poor will benefit. But this is not the way in which free market capitalists talk about the trickle-down economy of the last 50 or 60 years.
But he was referring to the former interpretation.
That's exactly. He's talking about
what we're familiar with in the West.
That's what I believe. Okay. I think from his experience, he's familiar with economic and social systems in which the elites of the economy, of industry, of government also enrich themselves, and from a macro GDP perspective, the economy does grow because there is wealth created, but the system does not, except by way of simple generosity, it doesn't allow the poor to raise their standard of living.
Father Leo, this is Michael Shaw, yeah. And I just have to say, I think, you know, the description you gave of this Spanish phenomenon or Latino phenomenon is still a pretty apt description of our experience of trickle-down economics. I mean, the 1% have garnered the vast majority of all the GDP growth in this country since the mid-1980s. Mm-hmm. So this idea that somehow it was a mistranslation, I would beg to differ. I think he's talking about global capitalism. I do think clearly you see this is a Pope from the global South, mm-hmm. and has a different experience of globalization. I think the language there is quite distinctive. Here and in some of his other comments. This idea that, it was mistranslated, he's not really talking about us. I think he is precisely talking about what we know as trickle-down economics. I think the attitudes are the same. I think you see the same idolatry of money that he condemns. I think you see the same resistance. He specifically condemns those who say the government has no role in trying to achieve the common good in economic relations. He condemns that. This is the Tea Party Catholic mantra. And it's not a Catholic mantra.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Pope Francis and his what he has said in the recent months since he became Pope. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Matt Abbott, what statements by the Pope or actions by the Pope have concerned you?
I think it's been, you know, the initial statement in that was made on the plane, and of course, understood in context, it really wasn't that controversial. But the soundbite that was picked up was, "Well, who am I to judge?" Mm-hmm. And I think that now that is in some cases being used, I think inappropriately
referring to homosexuality at the time, I think.
Correct. I believe specifically priests who have same-sex attraction, but those who are certainly living chaste lives, but who do struggle with the homosexual inclination. And again, you know, within context of Catholic teaching, there really wasn't anything that controversial about it. But it's interesting how a particular soundbite can be picked up and can be used in such a way that it almost sounds revolutionary, even though, again, when one looks at the teaching of the Church in regard to homosexuality, there was nothing that the Pope said that was contrary to that. And I think it's, again, it comes down to maybe a more of a way or a style of expressing, which, you know, in certain respects is refreshing. On the other hand, it does lend itself, I think, to some misinterpretation and in some quarters even misrepresentation.
Style.
I hate to be contradicting both of my panelists a little bit. There was something very revolutionary there, which is conservative Catholics have been arguing for a long time that the most important thing in life is the natural moral law, and that the most important thing the Church can do is write about the natural moral law and defend the natural moral law and condemn these kinds of, not just the actions, but, you know, the condemnation extends to the person. And what this Pope clearly is saying is that moral theology is a part of pastoral theology, but the primary part of the church's theological enterprise is to proclaim the love and mercy of God, and that the morals have to flow from that. I think in America, we're very content to reduce religion to ethics, and we're halfway down the slopes of secularization when we do that. So I don't entirely buy this, that, well, you know, if you read it in context and all that, I think, first of all, this is a man who's very astute. He's very bright, and I think he knows exactly what he's saying. And let's face it, you have had American bishops fighting same-sex marriage in this country who have been, you know, warning about civilizational threats and all this kind of stuff. And then here comes this guy who says, well, who am I to judge? And if that's not revolutionary, I don't know what is.
Leo Madden, is this a particularly American conflict over the Pope, the concern about these kinds of statements, or is it worldwide?
It's mostly an issue. The matters that we've been talking about the last 5 minutes are mostly matters of Northern Europe, the United States.
Okay, Western.
And largely secular Western civilization, where these are the first questions that are posed to any leader of any sort, whether that leader is religious, political, or social. Here is where one area where I had some misgiving regarding Pope Francis, where he said we don't need to be talking about abortion and gay marriage all the time. And in my experience, and the experience of all the people I asked about, they've never heard a homily that speaks about abortion, contraception, or gay marriage, hardly at all. What happens is that the media is very much interested in those questions, and those are the first questions that are posed. And so, my fear is, and I think there's going to be a leveling out of the roller coaster ride here with the release of this apostolic exhortation. My fear for a while is that the Pope was going to be sucked into the media agenda at every opportunity, and I hope that he is going to avoid that.
Matt Abbott, any thoughts?
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment. I think that, initially being also that I have been involved in pro-life activism throughout the years, maybe not as much as some have, but so it was a concern when the comment was made about focusing too much or obsessing on, although I can certainly understand, again, if looking, it's not good to obsess about any particular issue. But I still think that, the Pope places a great value on those who are involved in pro-life activism. And perhaps he may wish that some may take a different emphasis in certain respects. But nonetheless, I think, the pro-life movement is something that is very important in this day and age. And I think that also Pope Francis has talked about reaching out to those women who have had abortions and who have been hurt by abortions. And I also think that is a very important component of the pro-life ministry. And I know a number of conservative Catholics have been involved in that over the years.
We have an email from John in Columbus. I'll direct it to Michael Sean Winters of the National Catholic Reporter first, but of course anyone can comment on it. Can you ask your guests to address the issue of papal infallibility with regards to the grievances against Pope Francis?
I don't, the papal infallibility got a bad name. It is very rarely, if ever, invoked. The only time I think.
What does it mean first, Michael?
Well, it was first defined in 1870 at the First Vatican Council. And obviously, the Church, there's always been the belief that the Holy Spirit is active in the Church, and therefore the Church as a whole possesses a certain infallibility. When it, for instance, when the Council of Nicaea in 325 determined the creed that we say every Sunday at Mass, okay, that cannot be an error. And in 1870, when the Risorgimento army was at the gates, there was certainly a concern that what if you could not convoke a council to definitively proclaim an infallible teaching? And so they devised the idea that the Pope could exercise, on behalf of the whole church, this charism of infallibility. The only time anyone thinks it's been used, and there's even debate about this, was in 1950 when Pope Pius XII proclaimed the doctrine of the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary. Not exactly the most controversial issue. So I don't think infallibility gets into any of this. I do think, obviously, the Pope, in the exercise of what we call the ordinary magisterium, his day-in, day-out teaching office, we are called to, as Catholics, to assent to that and to believe it. He is teaching us what the Church teaches. He's teaching the faith. And so when people come out and say, you know, I find it funny when these economists say, well, you know, the Pope is not an economist, that sort of misses the point. He's not saying, look, this economic, you know, he's not doing a dissertation on economics here. He's saying this is what it means to be a Christian. And that's their problem, which is you can't wash this stuff off. The critique of capitalism is clear, not just in its results, and that there are so many poor still around the world, is that a system that is predicated on winners and losers, we're Catholics. We don't believe any human person is a loser. This is why we're pro-life. You know, I mean, it all hangs together. And so the critique is actually much, much deeper than the results or any economic theory. No statistician can come up with an authoritative response to what the Pope is trying to say.
Matt Abbott, just before the break, we'll hear from you.
I would essentially agree with Mr. Winters on that. I think, I know that there are some conservatives, I guess maybe some may call them neoconservatives, who, and I suppose they have more of a, or speak normally on secular politics, who were highly critical of Pope Francis in speaking about economics. But, I think in terms of the teaching of the Church in the Gospel, I think Pope Francis is certainly very knowledgeable of that, and I really think he is on the right track. And I really don't take any issue with the Pope in regard to anything that he's written in The Joy of the Gospel.
Okay. Well, we'll be right back. We'll talk about some of the things he has done, some of the actions he has taken since becoming Pope, Pope Francis, that is. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This hour, we've been discussing Pope Francis, his popularity, and the reaction to his views by conservative Catholics. Recently, rumors have circulated that Pope Francis occasionally dresses in regular priest garb and secretly ventures outside the Vatican to preach to the homeless. Those rumors are unconfirmed, but Stephen Colbert, or his conservative Catholic alter ego, had this to say about it.
He's a vigilante vicar coming to the help of those in need. He's the Bat Pope. Holy, holy Father Nation. It all makes so much sense now. He's just like Bruce Wayne. He's a wealthy bachelor who lives alone in a giant mansion. And Bruce Wayne has the Batmobile, while Francis has the Popemobile.
Which he doesn't care to use, by the way. All jokes aside, the new Pope has garnered a lot of attention for his views, but also some attention more maybe within the Church and within among scholars for some of the actions he has taken. For instance, recently he rearranged the membership of the congregation for the bishops. Leo Madden of Ohio Dominican University, tell us what that means and why it has raised eyebrows.
In the management of the worldwide Catholic Church, there exists a number of congregations and offices. One of these congregations, if you wish to use a parallel in the American government, it would be like a cabinet. All right.
Okay.
One of the congregations is the Congregation for the Bishops, and this is the place where decisions are made about who will be named a bishop in a various diocese or archdiocese around the world. And so since it is true that, you know, people make policy, it's important to be somewhat attentive to who are the members of this congregation. And what got headlines this past week is that one individual has been asked to step down. This is Cardinal Burke, and two Americans
from
he used to be the Archbishop of St. Louis.
Okay.
And he's currently still the head of the main court of church law in Rome. And two Americans were named, most notably the Archbishop of Washington, D.C., Cardinal Wuerl. And so those who, Vaticanologists, are seeing something there, what will this mean in regard to what sort of individuals will be named bishops? What will be the characteristics of Pope Francis bishops as opposed to John Paul II bishops or Benedict bishops?
And Michael Sean Winters, you're there in Washington, D.C. with the National Catholic Reporter. What are they talking about over there?
So it's hard to overestimate how important this was. I had dinner the other night with a Vatican official who said he could not remember a prefect of the signatura of this church court, which is Cardinal Burke's office, not being a member of the Congregation for Bishops. So this was, and also removed was Justin Regali, the former Archbishop of Philadelphia. And these were two Americans who were very influential in selecting more culture warrior style bishops. And you know, were replaced by someone who actually had a very public spat with Cardinal Burke on the issue of denying communion to pro-choice politicians. Cardinal Burke saying, you can't give communion to pro-choice politicians. And Cardinal Wuerl saying, you know, the Eucharist is not a weapon. It's not a reward for, good behavior. So this was as clear a signal as we've had that the Pope is not just going to talk about a different pastoral approach, but is going to put in place key leaders and assistants to help him create the next generation of bishops who are more in tune with his vision. And so this, this would be, equivalent to President Obama, as Father Madden alluded to, you know, reshuffling his cabinet in a major way. And I don't think anyone really saw it coming. I think they thought he would add a couple people, but the idea that he removed two, and in Cardinal Burke's case, he's only 65, which is, you know, you're young by Vatican standards at 65. So this was really, really stunning.
Another action he's taken, he appointed a team to investigate the Vatican Bank and eight cardinals to reform the Curia. I guess it's the people who run the Vatican. Michael, what do you make of that? That's something that a lot of people can understand, that these a bank investigation nowadays. That's, oh, yeah, okay, it's 2013. That's what we do.
Right. There were some financial shenanigans going on, and he appointed a pretty high-powered commission to look into this. They're still working on it. He also, it was announced today, they're bringing in an outside consulting firm to work on that, and a different consulting firm, the McKinsey Group, to help do a kind of organizational audit of their communications offices. So he's, but he very clearly, every time he talks about reforms, it's very clear to him that if there's not a spiritual reform, if it doesn't start with a pastoral reform, then, you know, you're just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, you have to, get people focused again on the mission of the church, which is, to preach the mercy and love of God. And I think this is one of the things, and it may be the most important reform he's done, it hasn't gotten much notice, is every 7 years, used to be five, all the bishops of the world at individual times, they go to Rome and they do what are called ad limina visits.
Right.
And so, groups of bishops from Ohio a couple years ago all went over as a group, and they met with the Pope. And the Pope will be sitting up on his throne, and they're all single file on either side, lined up like altar boys. And now the ad limina visits, all the chairs are in a circle. And they're all sitting around the table. You know, you're going to have a different kind of dialogue and interaction and Q&A when you're all sitting around the table. If the Pope is sitting up on the throne and they're all lined up like altar boys, there's no possibility of dialogue. This is the kind of change that the Vatican has sorely needed for a very, very long time. And you know, I don't want to say that, you know, interior decorating is the key to reform, but in a sense, it really is.
Matt Abbott, from where you sit, you know, as a Catholic columnist for Renew America, that's when I hear Michael Sean Winters describing that kind of a thing, I get that. I understand that. What about you?
Well, I would agree. I mean, Pope Francis is definitely a reformer, and I think the moves that he has made in regard to, if you will, reforming or reassembling his cabinet have been significant, most notably the replacing of Cardinal Burke, which is something that, you know, initially I was disappointed in. However, I will trust the Pope's judgment that perhaps this will ultimately be for the better, as the other reforms that he will make. And I think in some respects it is good that he is deciding to shake things up, because, you know, I do think the bureaucracy has been problematic for a long time. Maybe, you know, in some respects I might disagree with Mr. Winters as to, you know, particular aspects of that bureaucracy, but I don't necessarily think it is a bad thing that Pope Francis has decided to make these significant reforms in the Curia. Again, you know, I personally appreciate Cardinal Burke for his orthodoxy, and I appreciate his outspokenness on that matter, but I still think, you know, he could have some influence. Now, you know, it won't be perhaps what it was, but it may ultimately turn out to be in the best interests of everyone.
He is, getting back to the people who run the Vatican, and its resources, its vast resources, Professor Madden, can you talk about those people, how powerful they are in conjunction with the Pope or in opposition to the Pope, or can they control him? What do they bring to bear on this story?
I think you're asking, does Pope Francis have handlers, right?
Yeah.
And it appears to me that he has.
Or are they not?
For as long as he has physical strength and intellectual strength and will, he's going to be his own person. And he's shown this from the very first day when he was elected as Pope. He decided to live in the Casa Santa Marta because he wanted to be close with people. He has daily mass with the people who live there. He gives a homily at those masses. He eats breakfast with those people. He wanted to be with the common people as much as possible. And he's going to, so that this gives him an opportunity to look with an objective eye towards the individuals who work in the bureaucracy. Because he's not in it. Because he's not being controlled by them.
Does this irritate them?
We'll have to see. Okay. I think it will certainly irritate some.
They don't want to be living better than the Pope does.
No. Well, to be sure, we have to be charitable to the people who work at the Vatican. They work extremely long hours, and most of them, right, work very, very hard with very little support and with very little pay. But there is a sense of, there is a payment in terms of personal and political advancement that some are hoping for. And I think this Pope is giving a clear message. If you wish to advance up the ladder of prestige, you should change what you wish to your future to be.
Michael?
Yeah, I agree. And I think you will see this with the changes in the Congregation for Bishops and the selection of new bishops. I anticipate, whereas often bishops are chosen from seminary rectors, the people who lead the institutions where the church changes, teaches future priests. It's a very self-referential part of the life of the church, and this Pope has consistently said, you know, we can't be so self-referential. So I would look for new bishops to come from the ranks of those who have they've been directors of Catholic charities. You know, being a bishop, a lot of the work is administrative. You have to have somebody who has clearly, you know, demonstrated a capacity to hire staff, supervise them, and things like that. But also parish priests from large parishes where they have a school and a cemetery and a bunch of things to worry about. I think you're going to see those kinds of candidates being proposed as new bishops, and that has certainly not been the case. And you know, you're never going to break up the old boy network entirely, but clearly it's going to be a different set of old boys making the choices.
Last month, the Pope told Catholic bishops worldwide to invite parishioners' views on issues ranging from birth control to divorce. And I use the word told specifically because that's the way I read it. That's the way it was written. He told them to do that. Professor Madden, is this something that raises eyebrows again, or does every new pope ask people to get together and start talking about things like this?
Well, the great concern that many people have is it focuses on the issue of what is in the Latin term is sensus fidelium. That is to say, the sense of the faithful.
Okay.
To go back to a notion that Mr. Winter said a little bit ago regarding infallibility, the affirmation is made that the guidance of the Holy Spirit is such that it can preserve the whole church from error. And in the case of papal infallibility, the Holy Spirit can protect the church from error when the Pope speaks in a particular manner. Okay, so sensus fidelium, the sense of the faithful. How is that to be judged? Is that to be judged by means of a public opinion poll, or to be judged by the number of people who show up for a diocesan colloquium to express their opinion? How is the guidance of the Holy Spirit to be measured on these or any other particular matters? This is the concern that we have.
Matt Abbott, Catholic columnist for Renew America, how does that feel to you?
Yeah, I would agree. I do. I definitely have some concerns about it. I guess this might be still, you know, part of the roller coaster ride to come
okay.
as to what is going to take place, you know, in the coming months and years, and in regard to a survey like this, you know, how everything is going to unfold. I guess, you know, there's still some unanswered questions, and in fact, I guess time will tell as to how everything is going to play out. But it certainly is interesting, and, you know, I don't know how many Catholics have thus far, I guess, participated or taken advantage of that, but it's certainly an interesting way, I guess, of going about things, of trying to, I guess, get a sense of, you know, where the, if you will, average Catholic in the pew stands. And we know, I mean, based on various polls that continue to be done on a fairly regular basis, we pretty much know where American Catholics are, or that they're divided in regard to, you know, the key social issues of abortion and gay marriage and contraception and so forth. So it will be interesting to see how this all plays out.
See, Matt, real quickly, because we're running out of time, but the headline for a New York Times article said, conservative U.S. Catholics feel left out of the Pope's embrace. And that was the headline.
Right.
Is that what it feels like to you?
You know, not necessarily to me. I definitely have, you know, some concerns, although I am not as, I think, I guess, concerned or angry as some conservative Catholics okay. are in the direction of Pope Francis and where he seems to be leading the church.
But there and are I, some who are.
I definitely, yes. I get the sense there are some who are you know, very concerned, who are angry, and who definitely do feel left out of the Pope's embrace. As to, you know, whether they constitute a majority of conservative Catholics, it's hard to say.
Yeah.
I would say that, you know, there are some who are happy with the direction he's going in. There are those who are unhappy, and then there are also those who are kind of in between and unsure of exactly where they stand at this point. Maybe they're leaning one way or the
right.
other, but...
Time will tell. Matt Abbott, Catholic columnist for Renew America, thank you so much for joining us today.
thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Leo Madden, head of the Department of Theology at Ohio Dominican University, thanks to you as well.
Great to see you again, Ann.
And Michael Sean Winters, blogger and columnist for the National Catholic Reporter. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
Always a pleasure, Ann.
All right, and thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.